The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Friends, this is just a nice wee afternoon talk. Before I begin, somebody asked me whether any of the talks which I am doing here had been published. And I said no, because if they were, I'd be sued by the people who have been plagiarizing. Now, that's not strictly true. I don't believe that when people are invited to speak at Greenbelt, they should come to give a chapter out of their latest book. But there are things which I've done previously at Greenbelt, which are in a couple of e-books. And if you're interested in material from the community that I come from, the Iona community, Sticky Tent, which is over diagonally behind us, the Sticky Tent has a stall with a lot of materials that come from my neck of the woods. Now, I want to begin by remembering a thing that happened about 10 years ago when ScotRail had just begun to introduce an intercom which went from one carriage to another. And it enabled the people who were in charge of the trains to speak either to everyone and the driver or to speak only to the driver himself. And evidently this guard who was on the train I was in had not mastered the technology and wasn't sure which button to press when. So when we came out of Croy Station, the train was going from Stirling to Edinburgh, there was this very cautious voice saying, "This is the 8:38 ScotRail service to Glasgow Queen Street, calling at Lenzie and Bishop Briggs." The intercom went off, and then 10 seconds later, it came back on when, with a much more animated voice, the guard said, "Hoff Freddy, there's a big lassie in the back carriage with huge knockers, just the kind that you like." Freddy, the more sensitive and electronically sussed driver, then shut down the intercom system until we arrived in Glasgow. Now, it was 3 years later that I was travelling in a train from Glasgow to Edinburgh, another ScotRail service. The train was busy and I was standing in a vestibule. It was 7:30 in the morning. We'd hardly left the platform when a voice behind me said, "I haven't had a thing this morning. I haven't even had a drink. I'm so hungry I could eat a scabby horse." Now, as it happened, I had brought some sandwiches, though not of the equine variety, on the station platform, and I really only needed half the packet. So I turned round expecting to offer my unwanted sandwich to some homeless teenager who had sneaked onto the train. Instead, I was confronted with a spin stripe suited Glasgow lawyer whose announcement of desperate need was being made via a mobile phone to his girlfriend. Now, there's a distinct difference between these two occasions in which essentially private conversation became public domain. In the first instance, we have a novice using advanced passenger train technology and getting it wrong. In the second, we have a commuter, unconsciously perhaps, exhibiting his presumed right to dominate the morning meditations of fellow travellers by broadcasting to all and sundry regarding his empty stomach. Is this a postmodern dilemma, I fondly ask, but I won't answer that question. Although it might just be that as in political life and as in religious life, everything goes, there may just be a trend which is emerging within our private lives that we should get what we want when we want it, irrespective of whether that fits in with the designs of other people. So I'm going to explore in this seminar what might be regarded by some, but not necessarily by all, as a major change in the way we perceive reality. Namely, that personal need or personal desire, which in previous eras and in contexts would have remained in the personal realm, has become the subject of unfettered public articulation. And I'm pursuing this both because I believe it leads to a loss of context and perspective in life in general, and also because I perceive that there is a knock-on effect with regard to the life of faith. Now, I have to declare in all honesty that there are some things about which I'm about to speak which I know nothing about. I'm a part-time technophobe. I don't possess a mobile phone. I don't have a personal computer or a personal email address. I blush to admit that I have a video player, although my consolation is that last week, which is probably the second time in 3 years that I've used it, I had to find the instruction book in order to know how to use this particular instrument. But I don't think that you have to be an alcoholic before one warns about the evils of drink, nor do I believe that only those who have lobotomies can speak authoritatively about the loss of brain. So, let me go back to the mobile phone and to something which happened to my colleague Alison, who also uses public transport. She was travelling down the West Coast line, and at Preston, there got on the train and into her compartment a businesswoman who took over, as business people do in trains, the bay meant for four people, and spread her papers around so that nobody would dare go near her. Alison, like everyone else in the carriage, was then compelled to follow the conversation which this businesswoman then had with presumably her bosses in an office in London. She had just finished interviewing four or five people for a job, and courtesy of the airwaves and with the attentive ears of all people in the compartment, she was running down, or running over rather, those whom she had interviewed. Each person was named by name. Details of their life was transmitted down the phone in, as the French would say, plein air, open air. While the third applicant, a female, was having her benefits and disadvantages broadcasted, a woman called Marjorie Ryan, Alison went over to the businesswoman and said, "Excuse me, but you are talking about a close friend of mine, and I consider this highly offensive." At which the businesswoman blushed, put off the phone and apologised. Now, the truth was that Alison did not know Marjorie Ryan whatsoever. But it was an appropriate thing to say to get this woman to shut up, because what essentially was private information and what had been given in confidence, courtesy of this electronic device, was now the subject of gossip for everyone on the train. And who knows if perhaps Marjorie Ryan's family or friends could have been in that compartment travelling down from Preston. I've rarely been so bold, though sometimes on the afternoon train between Edinburgh and London I am sorely tempted, especially on a Friday when the business community joins at York and makes themselves available to their offices for the next 2 hours. There was one day last year when it was like spot the tune. I really thought that if only Rossini and Beethoven had been alive, they would have made a fortune out of the copyright fees just for the 2 hour journey between York and London. But back to Alison's case, which is maybe more pertinent. We have a situation in which private communication becomes public announcement, irrespective of whether or not the subject under discussion would assent to her or his details being made public. There are at least two other things that happen with this misuse, if I might call it that, of the mobile phone. The one is to do with other people's private space. It may be important for me to make this call, but is it important or convenient or desirable that other people should be compelled to listen to it? Is there no longer the possibility that in public places, be they parks or be they conference centres or be they churches or be they trains, is there no longer the possibility that these places meant for corporate enjoyment need to be dominated by private conversation? And you know, it is. I just realised the other day, because I follow this all the time, and somebody might want to say, well, you should go into the quiet compartment. Aye, that's where I am. And the mobile phones still come on. And then somebody says, I'm in the quiet compartment, and then they go out into the foyer, by which time your sleep or your meditations have been totally disturbed. And it strikes me that what intrigues us is Four people might be sitting at a table and conversing among themselves, and it never bothers you, because you know that this is a conversation where someone will speak, someone else will answer. But with a mobile phone conversation, it is only one way. And you become curious as to what the person on the other end might or might not be saying. And you're seduced. It's like being a voyeur, unwillingly, although it's through your ears. You're seduced into taking part in the conversation, especially when the message is predictably inane and seems predestined to end on a funny note of romantic intimacy. You know, "Hi, Sandra, just to tell you I'm on the train, love you." Why not say, "Bye-bye, Sandra, I have just caught a rocket to Mars, I hate your guts." If something negative, I'll not say harmful, but if something negative is happening to those compelled to listen, something negative is also happening to the phone user. In the first instance, he or she is witnessing to their belief that life is about doing what I want, when I want to do it, and damn everybody else. A fancy name for that might be hedonism. A more appropriate name might be self-abuse. We cannot have a balanced perspective on how we live our life if the primary agent to be satisfied is always our appetite. It's not just against the ethical teaching of the New Testament, it's against all the major philosophical strands of the East and the West. When we act in a public place, we should act with sensitivity to the possibility of our choices, our actions, having a concomitant effect on the choices or freedoms of others. My freedom to speak infringes another person's freedom to be quiet. Most of us, I suppose, would disdain parents who give their children what they want when they want it. We would call such children spoiled. The presumption in adult life that my desires are the number one priority in any given situation is evidence of a similar kind of spoiling. But there's also an issue which is not to do with egocentrism, but it has to do with kindness to ourselves. If Moses and Elijah and David and Mary and Jesus found time when they could be on their own to ponder what was important away from the crowd, what makes us so different that we want to take the crowd with us when we are on our own? The very thing which Jesus forsook. I don't want for a moment to dispute the value of mobile phones to women who have to make long journeys and dark nights, to social workers who have to enter houses where their lives may be in danger, to old or ill people who might need to call for help. Such realities are not in dispute. It's more to do with whether it is good for our souls as well as our attention span that we should be constantly interruptible, and that by our own design. There's an interesting story told about Lord Longford. Longford was a late Catholic peer, publisher, supporter of Myra Hindley, and producer of a government report on pornography. While Longford was still an active writer, he produced a book called Humility. It was published to mixed acclaim. About 2 weeks after its appearance, Longford walked past a reputable bookshop in London, and after looking in the window, went inside to speak to the manager and to ask him why he wasn't displaying his book on humility. Now, with Longford, a degree of eccentricity may have been the root cause of this odd inconsistency. But can we say the same about ourselves? We who claim the importance of quiet times with God, yet often bemoan the possibility of that happening. We whose faith, whether it be pragmatic Protestant or Anglo-Catholic, espouses the importance of an inner life. Can we honestly expect to culture such a thing when we make ourselves incessantly inaccessible to God, but accessible to everyone else? There are two words from my adolescence which come to mind, two words from very different books. One is a line in the Book of Days, which was published by SCM in the mid-60s. It was by Malcolm Boyd, who was an American chaplain to university students. And Boyd just kind of did a diary for a year in which he put down film reviews and things that students had written to him and some musings of his own. And on one of the days, there was simply the entry, "The telephone is an absurd instrument. It only has to ring." And that's precisely it. It doesn't matter, and you know this as well as I do, whether we're sitting, talking to someone in the quiet of our own house, someone who might be bent double in grief, or it might be that we're making passionate love to our spouse, the phone only has to ring and we must answer it, even if it's a double glazing company asking if we want an estimate. There's something disproportionate taking place here. What is more important, the distress of our friend or the phone which has just rung? Because to interrupt that flow of deep conversation in order to take something shallow is to dismiss or to count as nothing the level of intimacy which the conversation has moved to. What is more important, the passion of our beloved, whom we have just discovered, has either breasts like cluster of grapes or thighs of alabaster? I'm quoting scripture, this is a Christian event. Or the unwarranted intrusion of market forces. And I'm reminded of a line in another book by the late Metropolitan Anthony, who was the Russian Orthodox Archbishop in London. And in one of his books, Anthony Bloom says that if he is praying and the telephone rings, he will not answer it, but he will ask God, with whom he is engaged, to encourage the caller to ring back later if it's really important. And I have to ask, are we not worth giving ourselves silence? And is the God who created the world, is this God not worth silence? The God who created all things out of nothing, the God who saw us and named us when we were in the silence of the womb, is this same God not worth us switching off from the other voices so that when we re-engage with them, we do it in the context of the presence of the one who has eternity in his hands, and not just in the context of the urgent or casual expectation of the person who wants us to respond immediately? Now, I want to turn my attention to the net, and it may be that when I mention that word, people may be hoping that I might say something in condemnation of those who send spam about Viagra to 90-year-old celibate monks. I'm aware that for many people, the filtering out of what's essential is not always easy. Two weeks ago, I met a lecturer from Oxford University who had 8 different controls to try to eradicate spam from her email, and yet she still received it. And I've seen some of the casualties. Earlier this year, I was in a church in the southern states of America, and a young guy, about maybe 20, 30, called Jack, asked if he could speak to me. And it was almost by way of confession, although I suspect that he said the same thing to a good number of people. Jack's about 30, and he is considerably disadvantaged with regard to learning, and he's socially very awkward, but he's a whiz kid with computers. He has few friends, and he lives independently of his parents, and he certainly doesn't have much in his life by way of romance. But through spam or whatever, he's been connected up to porn sites and chat rooms, which have become an obsession. Now, who said that technology was morally neutral? I don't think I have an answer to Jack or to that whole realm of intrusion of which I know nothing. I wouldn't know the difference between the internet and a hairnet on a dark night. But I suspect that part of Jack's obsession is the result of seeing how, in the lives of less gullible people, the internet has come to dominate daily living. Some folks sit in front of a screen from 9 to 5 at work, typing in messages to other workers, and then return home at night to sit in front of another screen to continue business contacts or to surf or to communicate with friends. It astounds me how often when I go to stay with someone who I don't, you know very well, we'll go into, and this is not a kind of invitation that I get in the street, you want to come back to my house for coffee. It's not that, you know, if I'm working somewhere and somebody says, you can stay in my house. So I meet someone, do some work with them, I stay in their house, and I go back. And very often they'll say, when you go in the door, just go into the sitting room, make yourself comfortable, and I'll see you in a moment. And then they disappear for half an hour. Men longer, because men are so single-minded that they forget they've put a human being on hold. And when they return, they sometimes make comments about the inane messages which they have just read off their screen, and then they tell you what they have sent back. Now, I know that this might make people feel uncomfortable who do this kind of thing every time they go home, check and see what's on the net. But let me ask just a couple of questions. First of all, am I or are any of us so important that we should deem ourselves to be accessible all of the time? Is this not a false perception? That we cannot go half an hour or an hour or out for an evening, but when we come back, we have to see what has been sent to us, particularly those who do business from their own homes. It means there is no relaxed time. It means there is no family time. It means there is no free personal time. And our lives are dominated by a screen. And in some cases, the private dominates the public. The private relationship I have with my internet screen, my PC, is what dominates the conversation of the household, inasmuch as I absent myself from those with whom I'm publicly living. And one has to ask, as people who, this morning when we saw about 3,000 children coming into the centre of worship, we have to ask what the effect the screen has on family life. Now, I'm not a father. I have no axe to grind here. I only watch the children of others and comment on them. But last year, there were two surveys done quite independently which talked about the effect that the screen, whether that be the computer screen or the television screen, has on children. The one was looking at the sociability of adolescents, and it tried to find what was the common denominator which made in North America adolescents, when they turned 16 or 17, unable to engage socially with adults. The research went all across classes, and the discovery was that irrespective of rich or poor, that which enabled 17 and 18-year-olds to engage with adults was the experience of sitting round a table and having a meal as a family. And where adolescents or post-adolescents were particularly aberrant, where they had difficulty in relating to adults, it was the houses in which they were given their meal and told to watch the television, or given their meal and they could go upstairs and sit in front of the screen. The same researchers also discovered that the first purchase of an American family when they move into a new home is a television, and the last purchase is the dining room or the kitchen table. And last year, 2 years ago in Iona, we had a group of kids who came from Glasgow. And on the Saturday night, the first night when they were in the centre, they asked two questions. One is, why are we always going to have homemade food? And I understood that, because many of these kids would just get something heated up in a microwave. They wouldn't see their mother cooking. But the second thing was, are we always going to have to sit at a table? And when I said to the teacher, what's the reason for this comment? She said, at least a third of the children who are with me come from a house in which there is no kitchen table, where they're used to talking to adults. And this is a threat to them, although by the end of the week, it was a great joy to them to be talking to folk twice their age who expressed an interest in their lives. The other piece of research was on the attention deficit syndrome. And the researchers were trying to discover what it was that caused kids who, over the age of 7 or 8, to be unable to concentrate for any longer than 4 or 5 minutes, although there was not something which was psychologically wrong with them. And the researchers discovered that for every hour which a child below the age of 3 spends in front of a screen, either a television screen or a computer screen with some kind of thing on it that will change every couple of seconds to keep attention, for every hour that a child under 3 is compelled to sit in front of a screen, that child has a 10% greater chance over 7 of having an attention deficit syndrome. And you and I will have seen this. I was in a pastor's house in Glasgow last year, and he invited a couple and their two children, to come and have lunch. So there would have been about 8 of us at the table. The couple who came had a girl who was 15, and she sat at the table and talked. They had a boy of 7, and he would not sit at the table. But he plugged something into the television, and up came this game, and he engaged with this game, which made lots of crashing noises. And the conversation at the dinner table was disrupted because this boy wanted to do that thing. And I wondered, you know, when he's 17 or 18, or when he's 70 or 80, will he still feel that the public space is where he should get his own private thrill? As Christians, we cannot talk about family values and not ignore the effect which technology has on that which makes for good communication within the household. But there's another issue with the internet, and it has to do with whether it actually devalues or increases our appreciation of language. And as people of the book, you know, we are enjoined, whether we are preachers or whether we are worshippers, to have 3 loves in our life: a love for God, and a love for people, and a love for language, because it's through language which faith is communicated. And there is, I suppose, with the internet, because it's so instant, a kind of devaluing at times of what makes for good communication. Take, for example, an email which came recently into my office. It said, "Hi, John. My wife and I were at a seminar you took recently. We thought it would be good for our church. What are the chances? Mike." Well, I wrote back in slightly more expanded form. "Dear Mike, 1, who are you? 2, what seminar are you referring to? 3, when are you thinking I might come to your church? And 4, which country are you writing from?" I had naively thought it was Liverpool because I'd been there the week before. The man lived in Los Angeles. But there was nothing in the email to indicate the point of origin. I think of an equally cryptic range of messages running to some 24 pages which came sporadically from an Anglican diocese where clearly people just shunted off their latest thought and copied it to other people who were also engaged in this conference. The initial request was that I should conduct morning and evening worship for the diocese at a conference centre in Scarborough. I phoned a week earlier, just before I booked the train ticket, to discover that the event was one where I wouldn't be leading morning and evening worship for 4 days. I'd be doing one seminar on Celtic spirituality, and it wasn't in Scarborough, it was in Blackpool. Now, I have a dossier of such communication or non-communication, a communication which is not joined up, which comes from the sloppy habit of thinking that rather than, "Oh, what all do I need to say and how can I say it gracefully? No, I'll just dash off this thought and then another thought," and put pressure at the recipient to have to respond immediately. Somebody sends a message requiring information right away because there's a deadline. And it could be anything from a business colleague who's about to clinch a deal to a friend who needs to know tonight how to make your recipe for roast quail and pomegranate sauce. That happens to me all the time. And so this person's private agenda suddenly disrupts your work or your leisure time and puts you under pressure to respond. Or, as happens to some of us, we're asked for a reference or an indication as to somebody's fitness for a job. And I never reply to these things urgently. I won't. Because I think to make such an instant reply is to share in the neurosis of the person who's making the urgent request. So 2 days later comes another email saying, I know you have opened your mailbox, but you have not responded to me so far. And occasionally my response is to tell this screwed up, over anxious, indisciplined antagonist that the answer to their request is gestating. If I'm going to give somebody a reference, I want to muse over what the job is like. If I haven't seen them for a while, I might want to telephone them. I might want to pray about it. I am not instantly going to give a reference if I value this person and if I think that a meditated response is what is required. And I believe in gestation of ideas as much as of children in the womb. And that being the case, the private needs of one individual are not going to dictate the pace of my public work or my home life. But there's a third area where this kind of breaking down of the essential difference between private and public is seen. And that's in the passion which people have for reality television and its accompanying aberration of the Jerry Springer type chat shows. Now, I don't need or really wish to describe what happens in either. People will have seen both. And the one, you have a dozen people who have been pre-selected, flung together with nothing to do except get on each other's nerves for a period of time. Any semblance that that has to do with reality has more to do with the fact that it's on the same channel as the news than any relationship that has to real life. For where in anyone's life do they normally spend weeks on end in an enclosed space, wired up from morning to night and constantly in camera? The Springer-type interviews will, I'm sure, be seen by a future generation to be as abhorrent as we think Victorian freak shows were in the past, where people's physical abnormalities were the stuff of public entertainment. What I want to suggest about this type of attractive programming is this. First of all, what is fit for the psychologist's couch is not appropriate for public entertainment because it's in the wrong context. Intimacy, whether that be sexual or romantic or confessional or simply an honest talk between two friends, is something which is deeply personal. It's not geared for audience consumption. But if, like monkeys in a cage, people are aware of others looking, then they'll play up to the camera and any semblance between normal behaviour and role play will be minimal. But more than that, and this particularly refers to the extravagant and gratuitous exhibition of human vulnerability, when we're dealing with issues of intimacy, of honesty, of abuse, even of longing and desire, we are not dealing with shallow things. God has not made us to have superficial lives. And that which is profound within us is not up for public consumption. Now, previous day, the German theologian Paul Tillich had a lovely expression when he said that there was no depth unless there was a way into the depth. If somebody wants to discover what makes me tick, it's going to take more than a camera up my nose to discover it. If somebody wants to find the real reason why I hate my lover or I'm addicted to alcohol or have a fixation on a celebrity or suffer from unremitting depression, a series of quick-fire questions to frame the dilemma into 10 minutes is not going to do it. There has to be a way into the depth. And we know that the best conversations that we have with other people don't begin with the most profound moment, but there is a way in. That lovely encounter that Jesus has with the woman at the well is exactly of that variety. John's Gospel gives a whole chapter to that encounter. And it's a beautifully ambiguous story at the beginning, where this woman sees a dusky stranger sitting at a well. And she wonders what he's there for. And it's midday, And it's very hot, and nobody in their right mind would be sitting at a well, and nobody in their right mind would be going to fetch water. But down she goes, because this might just be a special wee encounter. And there's a conversation which takes place between Jesus and the woman, which is highly ambiguous. And because so often we hear the gospel through the voice of our childhood pastor, we don't see the ambiguity in it. He asks for a drink. And she thinks, well, this is the first request. What might follow up? He tells her that he can give her water which will last forever. And she says, oh, I'll have some of that. And that'll save me having to run up and down the stairs 8 times a day. And he says, go and call your husband. And she thinks, what has that to do with a drink of water? And he says, go and call your husband. And she thinks, he's trying to find out if I'm married. And he says, go and call your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. In other words, I'm free. And he says, you're dead right, you don't have a husband. You've had 5, and that man up the stairs is not one of them. And after this amusing and light and to some extent flippant conversation, where the humour which is through John's gospel from beginning to end finds a lovely moment. After that, Jesus begins to talk to her about who she is and who God is, with such effect that she becomes the first evangelist, because she goes into the nearby town and tells other people, come and see a man who understands me perfectly. But there is no way into the depth of her soul. Jesus does not say to her, do you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and therefore are you saved? No. He asks for a drink of water. And after a long while, the conversation becomes much more profound. When you try to force the depth of an individual into the limelight of public scrutiny, you both debase the individual and you abuse the medium. To force the private truth into the public forum through a set-up situation of conflict, as happens in reality television, as happens in the Springer-type interviews, is as unnatural as force-feeding. Now, what has this all to do with faith? Well, it's simply my contention that when you have a society which constantly blurs the line between public and private, and when people have grown used to seeing personal choice as the arbiter in any situation, and the exhibitionism of interior life on the public media as a norm, it has a knock-on effect on the way people see the church and the Christian faith. Let me take an example from a funeral and one from a wedding. This seems highly improbable, but it was told me at a conference of people in Northern Ireland. It was the Belfast Hospice, where there's care for the dying, and one of my colleagues and I were there looking at how we celebrated death, and it was a great, great day. And in the course of it, a nun from North Belfast told the story about what had happened in her parish when a man who was in his 80s had died. And given the shortage of Catholic priests, sometimes it's the sister who'll go and arrange the funeral. So she went to this family, who were very good church-going Christians, and she gave her condolences to the mother and to the 3 daughters, and they began to discuss the Requiem Mass, because it was going to be a big Mass. The man was very well known, the family very well loved. So they discussed who would do the prayers of the people, they discussed who might help to serve the Eucharist, they discussed who might do the readings, because in the Catholic Mass there's a great possibility for engagement of the congregation. And then they began to talk about the music. And the oldest of the 3 girls said, oh, we'll have to have my daddy's favourite tune at his funeral. Oh, said the nun, and what's your daddy's favourite tune? And she said, the teddy bear's picnic. So the nun had this vision at the end of a very ritualistic mass of the coffin having been sensed, because in this body the Holy Spirit of God had dwelt, and the coffin being sprinkled, because as this person was baptised into the death of Christ, so they'd be raised with Christ to new life. And the undertaker's men, having the coffin on their shoulders, the benediction had been given, and then the organ begins. Da dum da di 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 da 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 di 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 di. Oh da 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 da. So I said, "What do you say?" She said, "Well, nothing in my formation had prepared me for this moment." But I said to the girls, "Do you think that everybody was aware of your dad's musical tastes?" And the girls, who are all, you know, big women, said, "Oh no." The one of them said, "No, no, 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 no." She said, "No, that was a kind of joke. When we were wee girls, my dad would always sing, 'If you go down the woods today,' and he'd put his fingers up to his ears and he'd make a funny face." And she said, "In fact, 2 weeks before he died, we were all standing around his bed, and somebody began to sing this, and we're all making funny faces and doing this to my dad." "No," she says, it was in the family." So the nun, with great perception, said, "Well, I think it's very important that this is a very personal thing for you. And what I'll do is I'll come on the morning of the funeral and we'll stand round your dad's body, or his coffin, depending where the body is lying, and we'll play the Teddy Bear's Picnic on a cassette, and then we'll tell stories about all the things that come back to your memory. And then when we go to the church for the Requiem Mass, we'll have music that everyone can relate to, because everybody loved your dad. And it would be good that everybody could share in the celebration." And that was a lovely insight, that public worship should not be held ransom to the private desires of one person, even if it is the bereaved family. And then I think of a marriage which I was at, where this couple, in profound love for each other, as should be the case, were facing each other and were repeating their marriage vows. But there was among those who were attending a child whose parents were keen that the church should be child-friendly and that any service should be child-friendly, and so they had let Jason wander off. And as people's eyes were focused on this couple making their vows, from between, or rather from over the pulpit rails, poked this head, waving to Mum and Daddy. Now, of course, it was very amusing. But is there nothing profound, sufficiently enough, that in that moment, the private and innocent desires of the child should be allowed to pervade and to spoil the moment of committed intimacy of a husband and a wife? Where we are now in many churches is in a situation where, partly because people don't have a very fulfilling personal devotional life, the church becomes more and more the place where we expect our private needs to be met. And so we move from church to church, we go from service to service according to what we get out of it. And we will judge worship according to how we feel at the end of it. And this is something which is seen in a whole realm of things. There's a survey done 10 years ago by a fundamentalist publisher in New Zealand which looked at worship songs in the 50s and worship songs now, and saw that one of the main changes was the displacement of God and Jesus and the encouragement of I. I want, I need, I desire, as being the primary thing, the first person singular in the corporate worship of Almighty God. Or that these kind of songs, and I speak as someone who writes songs and have to be as critical of myself as I have of other people, these kind of songs which seem to exhibit desires for God which perhaps would be better fulfilled with an understanding friend. I just want you to come near me. I just want you to touch, you to kiss. Now go and get a girlfriend. You know, there are some things that God is not going to do. And that kind of thing, all that does is to exhibit that the person who writes that and the person sometimes who sings that is somebody who, in the privacy of their own space, is unable to or is not being encouraged to culture a devotional life with God. And therefore, when they come into the public forum, that's where they expect that their private needs will be met. And that has a number of bad effects for the church. One of which is that we expect the gospel to be self-gratifying. And if we're not self-gratified, we presume that that's not the gospel. You know, I could take us through every instance when Jesus is within religious precincts, when he's at the synagogue, when he's in the temple. And there is no instant in the whole of the four gospels as they reveal Jesus Christ in the religious precincts where people get what they want. It's never a case of a normal service because Jesus is here. For some there is blessing, and for some there is upset. It is in the synagogues that people plot to kill him, because he welcomes those who no one else would welcome, because he speaks of the kingdom of God in ways that upset those who want it to be a fairly gentle and docile thing. And if we want to be engaged with this Jesus Christ, then we cannot expect that the gospel will always be that which makes us feel comfortable. If it does, then perhaps it's not the gospel. And the other thing, just briefly, which happens when the personal desires, the egocentrism, the desire in the public place for private need to be met, is that the churches become less prophetic. I had an interview yesterday with a man from the BBC who was asking about Greenbelt and talking about how he was alluding to the seminar I did yesterday morning, which was about America post 9/11 and in the Iraqi context, and talking about how there were some things said there and some things said in other people's seminars which would not be said in local churches. And I wonder why not. Is it that we spend so long trying to keep people happy that the radical edge of prophetic preaching, that the radical sides of prophetic thinking, that the dreaming and the envisaging of the kingdom to which we're called goes out the window, and instead we try to keep everybody happy? The church has never been renewed when the centre got it right. The church has always been renewed by sceptics, by dreamers, by visionaries, by oddbods on the outside. And there always needs to be in the church a place where, even in our normal services, not just once a year, the issues of justice and inclusivity, of international debt, of money laundering, of impoverishment, of social exclusion, these are all mentioned, because we cannot have the gospel or the scripture and exclude that which God has deemed important. Now, it may be that in a moment folk will want to make comment or ask questions, and I'm very happy for that. But I would just hope that when we go from here, we might try to think in our own lives as to whether, be it the cell phone or be it the internet, whether we encourage what is essentially private to be foisted on others in a public forum where it is not appropriate. Because if we do that, we'll be like the honeymoon couple from Glasgow who decided on their wedding night not to stay in the hotel in which they were booked because their relatives were staying there, but went in a car into deepest Ayrshire and came upon the village of Kilmores and discovered that the local hotel there was full, but the hotel manager said, if you go along the road, just three doors down, there's a couple who sometimes take in people. So they knocked this couple's door, and the man and wife said, yeah, you can come in. We've got accommodation. Just for one night, that'll be okay. So they led them into a kind of fairly musty room in which there were two single beds, and then left the honeymoon couple to themselves. And the guy who wanted to avail himself of the facilities, when he came out the toilet, just happened to open another door and see this large double bed, which was much more inviting. and said to his new wife, I'm sure that they wouldn't mind if they understood our predicament, if we just went into this next room and shared the double bed. So they crept in all silently and fell into each other's arms and eventually went to sleep. And the next morning woke up to discover themselves in the shop window of a furniture store. Now, okay, there's about, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. If folk want to ask a question, there's a instrument here which can either stay up here or be put in the grass if that's easier for people to talk into. I don't see anybody coming, so I'm not going to delay things. I just want to say, on behalf of all the people who speak at Greenbelt, a very profound thank you to you who come to hear folks say things, some of which you agree with and some of which you don't agree with. But that's the nature of faith, that we engage with others who don't necessarily say the things that we would like to hear. It's never a prerogative and it's never a presumption to speak before an audience like this. It's always a privilege. Thank you very much.